Over the years, black athletes, through conspicuous activism, have proven their ability to affect outcomes off the field as well as on. Muhammad Ali forced America to think differently about Vietnam. More recently, the Mizzou football team drew national attention to campus racism. An iconic moment occurred at the 1968 Olympics when medalists Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised gloved hands in a Black Power salute denouncing racism. That brings us to our next guest, Dr. Harry Edwards. He is the driving force behind the Olympic Project for Human Rights that produced the Carlos Smith protest. He's the author of the book, The Revolt of the Black Athlete, and he joins me to talk about his life's work in the field of the sociology of race and sport. Dr. Edwards is a native St. Louisan and emeritus professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and he joins us by phone. Dr. Edwards, so nice to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, I'd like to quickly run down a list here that I have in front of me. I'll point out, as I did in the introduction, the Mizzou football team protest over campus racism. Football player Colin Kaepernick, national anthem protest against police brutality, knelt during the national anthem. Football and pro basketball players active in the Black Lives Matter protests. Pro athletes protesting transgender-based bathroom legislation in North Carolina. Boston Patriot football players refusing to go to the White House for a Super Bowl honor. It says to me that your work is still very much a work in progress.
Yes, it's ongoing, but this is something that I've been aware of for some time, being a student of developments at the interface of sport, race, and society in particular. It was very, very clear that there were ongoing waves of athletic activism that were essentially framed up by historical developments of the moment, whether it was abject segregation with Jack Johnson and Jesse Owens, Joe Lewis, whether it was an effort to desegregate with Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby and Kenny Washington and Chuck Cooper, Errol Lloyd, and those guys, or whether it was the Black Power movement, which instituted a new frame of reference that went beyond the civil rights desegregation effort. We're now in a fourth wave of athlete activism, as you stated, that was framed up by Black Lives Matter movement, and it's just a matter of time before a fifth wave, which is already well this side of the athletic political horizon, takes hold, and people begin to understand that these athletes who are making literally tens of millions of dollars a year are not biting the hand that feeds them when they make statements like Steph Curry recently did about the comments of the owner of one of the companies that he that sponsors his endorsements. They are biting the hand that they feed. This thing is flipped. These are powerful, walking corporations, and they literally have the ability to exercise economic and political power.
You know, if we look back on the earlier generations and some of the athletes you mentioned from decades ago, doing what they did took a tremendous amount of courage because they were black in America and not certainly fully accepted. And so they were stepping out and putting their position forward, which was a tough thing to do. Is it any less courageous today?
Oh, absolutely not, because African-American athletes are still black in America, and it still takes courage to step out front, because you still risk everything, including your life. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to make a statement when people are saying, essentially, go play the sport, entertain me, sit down and shut up. I mean, people challenge Colin Kaepernick because he took a knee during the playing of the national anthem. They would have challenged him if he had taken a knee during the playing of Chopsticks, because what they really want him to do is to sit down and shut up. They don't want to hear it. So nothing has changed in that regard. It's not that we haven't made progress. We obviously have. It's just that there are no final victories because the dynamics of the developments at the interface of race, sport, and society continue to evolve and change.
You know, and there's another element, too, I think is probably an important one when it comes to the courage aspect of it. And that is, as you've pointed out, these folks have been making an awful lot of money, and they are putting that earning potential at risk by coming out in some instances.
Well, you know, that has really changed a great deal when Bill Russell and Jim Brown and, of course, Smith and Carlos essentially sacrificed everything. Ali lost three prime years in his boxing career. Arthur Ashe was reviled because of his stand on apartheid and American support for apartheid and his pressure to divest from South Africa. Kurt Flood put everything on the line when he refused to be traded from the Cardinals to another team against his will and interest. That remains. But the major difference today with regard to all of that is that it has flipped. These athletes literally wield tremendous power, and they still put a lot on the line. They put everything on the line when they step up and speak out. Not least of all their lives. We live in some very dangerous and draconian times, and they have families, they have people that they're associated with, they have friends and so forth that they have to be concerned about.
You know, there are a lot of people in our society today who resent public figures coming forward and taking public positions on controversial issues. It happens with actors and actresses and certainly with athletes. How does this shape up in your mind in terms of this resentment?
Well, I mean, that has always been there. There's nothing that has changed with regard to that. People go to the movies to see the storyline and the plot in the film. They don't go to see Susan Sarandon rip the new presidential administration or what have you. They go to a football game to watch two teams participate. They don't go to see Kaepernick make a political statement. And, of course, that is considered an intrusion on their rights, on their prerogatives, and that's not what they're paying for. But that is a part of history. It has always been that way. No one who speaks out has ever been welcomed with open arms for the most part, even when people say things like, I understand the message. The reality is that silence has always been evil's greatest and most consistently dependable ally. And that is what people really want, even in the face of the grossest, most grievous kinds of transgressions, especially by authorized authorities, such as the shooting of black men, women, and children by police officers.
The entertainment is not your bailiwick, I know, although, like most of us, you're probably most interested in it. So I'm going to digress for just a moment here. What would you anticipate Sunday night at the Academy Awards? I think there's going to be the potential for an awful lot of comment there.
I would be surprised if there were not comment. I have another interest in it. One of the films, O.J. Made in America, is up for an Oscar as a documentary that I participated in and have been featured as part of the trailer for it going into the Academy Awards. So I'll be watching it from that perspective. But I'd be very, very surprised if some of the people who are exceptionally conscious, articulate, involved and committed do not take the opportunity to make statements, particularly at this historical moment with this particular presidential regime. It's unique in so many ways. I mean, people talk about the racism, the misogyny, the xenophobia. They talk about the religious bigotry. We've had religious bigots in the White House. Richard Nixon was anti-Semitic. We've had racists. Woodrow Wilson was a committed racist. He kept Paul Robeson from going to Princeton because he didn't think a black individual should play on the football team at that school when he was president of the university. We've had most certainly xenophobic people such as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was xenophobia that led to his signing of that order to intern Japanese Americans. And, of course, every president in there just about has struggled at some level with misogyny, including Barack Obama. But what we have not had is somebody who is almost pathologically ignorant, who flaunts it as if it were a virtue. And I think that you're going to find people who more and more come to object to that, and I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't see it in award ceremonies like the Oscars and the Emmys and so forth.
Well, and the added dimension this year, of course, is the fact that By far, there are many more African Americans represented in the Oscar ceremony this year than has been the case in the past. A number of films that dealing with issues of relating to African Americans and actors and actresses as well. I think that's why a lot of people would suspect there will be some comment at this year's awards.
Yeah, well, I mean, that in and of itself deserves comment. I mean, why would that not be the case every year to the point that it's commonplace and nobody notices it anymore? The fact that you have a film documenting James Baldwin's contributions to the public intellectual debate about race and society up for an Oscar against the film that I participated in. I knew James Baldwin. I'm at one level really pulling for that film to win because it will get people to go out and see it or at least check it out on cable. And but why should that be the case? Why should it be exceptional that you have these entries up for the Oscar? And I feel just as strongly about the contributions of women as something more than actresses. There are directors, there are film people, there are editors, all of these women who made such a great contribution to the industry, to the entertainment industry, who historically have not been recognized, taken seriously.
Well, maybe that is changing with this year, changing a permanent change. We shall see. By the way, I'm told that your film, the O.J. film, is odds-on favorite to win Best Documentary.
I would love that because I think O.J. was really about us as a people and a nation, who we were at that time, and the trajectory of where we were headed. I do so many documentaries over the course of two or three years. I had literally forgotten about my contributions to the O.J. Simpson piece, and then all of a sudden I began to get letters. Hey, Dr. Edwards, I saw that documentary that you did on O.J. is up for an Oscar. Are you going down? No. That's not the kind of thing that I enjoy, but I will be watching it on TV.
Well, come on. All the accolades you've had, I'll bet you the Oscar is right up there in terms of the excitement factor.
I would love to see it. I would love to see it happen for Ezra Edelman. His family has been so illustrious in the whole struggle for freedom and justice in American society for so long that I think it would be great if he won. But at the same time, I knew James Baldwin. I read everything. He was instrumental in me coming of age politically, The Fire Next Time, Giovanni's Room, Another Country, Notes of a Native Son. And, of course, he was just simply brilliant to sit and listen to him speak and to have the experience that I did to sit in a room with Maya Angelou, who wrote the introduction to my autobiography, The Struggle That Must Be, and James Baldwin, and just listen to them talk until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning was one of the tremendous highlights of my life.
And then we've got August Wilson represented also.
Fences. Absolutely.
Fences. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, that's a different category. That's in the category of drama and not documentary, so I can just look at that and enjoy it.
I have to take a quick break here. Stay with us, Dr. Edwards. We'll come back. I want to get back to the sports arena, if you will, and we'll do that in just a moment. My guest is Dr. Harry Edwards, author of The Revolt of the Black Athlete. He is an expert on the sociology of race and sport. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, give us a call at 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Dr. Edwards, one of the things that I've been reading about you and getting ready for this program concerns an interview that you had on the Colin Kaepernick, the 49ers quarterback who, as you put it, took a knee during the playing of the national anthem as part of a protest movement. One of the things that you said that kind of made me want to ask you this question is you equate what he did with what Muhammad Ali did in the 60s with regard to the Vietnam War. I find that hard to accept, given the impact of Ali's demonstrations and actions.
Well, the impact of Ali's demonstrations and reactions in retrospect is what it is that you're reacting to. The major impact that Muhammad Ali had was in shifting the framing of the discussion. The first time I met Ali was in 1960. He was on the boxing team, and they were training at San Jose State because San Jose State's boxing coach, boxing was a collegiate sport at the time, was Julie Menendez, who, by the way, was also from East St. Louis, which is how I ended up at San Jose State. And he introduced me to Ali. And the one thing that I saw about Ali, that he was of a different cut. He was brilliant. He was bombastic. And he was not like the traditional mold of black athletes at that time. Do your boxing in the ring, keep quiet, leave, and don't say anything, and most certainly don't do what Jack Johnson did, which is to flaunt your brilliance and flaunt your success. Ali broke with that. He came out screaming, "I'm black and I'm beautiful," and so forth and so on, especially after he became Muhammad Ali. This is why the difference was that Ali was not Joe Louis, just as Tommy Smith was and John Carlos was not Jesse Owens. Bill Russell was not Earl Lloyd. Jim Brown was not Kenny Washington. Arthur Ashe was not Althea Gibson. It was a paradigm shift and a break. This is the same thing that happened with regard to Colin Kaepernick. There were statements that were being made by black athletes, St. Louis Rams players running on the field in the hands up, don't shoot gesture, other athletes making statements. But once the national anthem played and so forth, they were essentially into their game. They were looking forward to the kickoff. What Colin did as a injured backup player who was not even active was to make a statement during the course of a scheduled event associated with the game. People began to look at that. That shifted the intensity and the focus of the argument and discussion. And this is why, knowing sports as I do, and having been a student of sport for 50 years, I got in touch with the Smithsonian and told them they better get his shoes and jersey and the Time magazine with him on the cover and the rest of it in the Smithsonian, because 5 years from now they probably wouldn't be able to afford it. People will look back at the Colin Kaepernick demonstrations and understand that there was a paradigm shift there that literally upgraded and intensified the character and caliber of the discussion around issues of race in American society. That argument that the Kerner Commission report in 1968 following Dr. King's assassination had called for, and nobody had been able to achieve that until a mixed-race kid who grew up in Turlock as part of a white family and played his college ball at University of Nevada, Reno, took a knee and said, essentially, we are better than this. We don't need to treat each other this way. And it shifted the focus of the argument and discussion to the extent that the President of the United States, from a podium in Beijing, China, was answering questions about the extent and the degree as Commander-in-Chief he understood or supported Colin Kaepernick's protest during the playing of the national anthem. That is significant. And as we get through this thing, and we're going to come out of it better, as we get through it 50 years from now, just as we look back on Ali, we will look back on Colin Kaepernick and say, yeah, that was a contribution. I don't care if he doesn't do anything for the rest of his life.
Is he paying the price, though, for that now? I mean, the accolades may come later, but is he paying any kind of a price because he is not one of the big, big marquee names that some of whom you've mentioned?
Well, of course he's paying the price. I mean, it's not the price that a lot of people think he's paying. People wrote about, well, he split the locker room. He doesn't even play, and at the end of the game, the reporters all around his locker while the players who took the hit are standing over in front of their lockers and nobody's interested in their perspectives and so forth. The reality is that at the end of the season, Colin Kaepernick was voted by his teammates to receive the highest award that the San Francisco 49ers give, the Lynn Eschman Award for Character, Courage, and Leadership. He was voted almost unanimously by his teammates to receive that award. They had pictures of people burning his jersey. But by the end of the season, the number one selling NFL jersey in the country, exceeding Tom Brady and the Manning Boy and everything else, was Colin Kaepernick's jersey. And had the season continued on, it would have become the highest selling jersey in NFL history. So, yeah, there are some things that he's paying a price for. He can't just walk into a restaurant and sit down and eat because he don't know who's cooking his food. Like I told him, when I was involved in activism in the 1960s, if it wasn't a smorgasbord or an all-you-can-eat family place, I didn't go in there and eat because the only way I could feel safe is that if they didn't know I was coming. So at the end of the day, yeah, there are prices to be paid. But for the most part, I think that in the end, they will look back on what Colin did. And those who are honest and open and understanding will simply say, hey, young brother, well done. It took courage, insight, and conviction, and you came right up to the top of the pile on, in terms of all of those.
What kind of conversations have you had with him about this? Does he talk about his motivation and about the aspect of courage?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm a counselor for the 49ers, have been for 31 years. And Colin and I talked on the very first day that he came on board. I was involved in his selection. We drafted him in the second round, a tremendous athlete, 6'5", you know, 250 pounds, was running a 4.38 40 and had an arm like a howitzer. And so we saw tremendous possibilities in him. And part of my job was to make sure that he grew and evolved in terms of his football and in terms of his citizenship. And it was a tough transition to the big stage. And so we talked all the time. And there was never a time that I was in camp when he wouldn't walk over and say, hey, Doc, I need to read something. What do you think of it? Give me some books. I gave him autobiography of Malcolm X. I gave him James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time. He asked me about various articles and so forth. I gave him works by Angela Davis and Maya Angelou. I gave him the original Richard Wright, Notes of a Native Son, and so forth. So all of this, he was just simply flat-out devouring. My own hope is that he will eventually go to the university and get himself a PhD and decide what he wants to do with his life and in that sense, because he's an absolutely brilliant young man.
Where is all of this taking us? And by all of this, I mean, it seems to me that we're in a period right now of kind of hyper-protest. We see it on so many different fronts. Certainly the political season has given us more than most of us can handle. But do you agree that we are in that kind of a phase right now? And if so, where does it take us?
Well, a lot of it depends upon what happens in Washington, D.C., of course, with the guy that's in the White House. I mean, I look at it in many ways. People look at him, and you look at the protesters. He was called everything but a child of God. But I look at it kind of differently. I mean, I watched Barack Obama over his years in the White House. He came in a spry, young, energetic adult, and he left. He looked older than Nelson Mandela. His hair was white as snow. Well, here we have a guy who is the oldest individual ever to assume the job of president, a geriatric, a grossly overweight insomniac who has a fast food Jones, is into hamburgers, fried chicken, and who can't take stress or pressure. I mean, to me, I don't know, maybe it's just wild-eyed speculation on the part of a social psychologist, but that sounds to me like a problem that's ultimately going to take care of itself. And so I think that at some point, I would not be surprised at all if the responsible adults ended up going into the White House after our first national and international crisis, trussling him up in a straitjacket and hauling him out the back door on a gurney over to Bethesda Naval Hospital. So I look at it in many different ways, but in any event, we are a divided society, and ultimately we're going to have to come together, and that is not going to be easy because we're disinclined to listen to each other. We tend to listen to what is reflected off of each other by our leaders and our leadership structure. So the lot of progressive people's vision of the other side of the aisle is reflected in what's bounced off of them by the Donald Trumps of the world, the Jeff Sessions, and so forth. And I think that that's unfortunate because that means we're not listening to each other. We're responding to the dog whistles and the cowbells that are used basically for a political gain by those who would exploit our divisions. So we are in a difficult time. It's going to take commitment, and we have to keep in mind that no major society, no major civilization has ever collapsed from external assault. They collapse from internal contradiction and division. That is what we have to keep our eyes on and have to begin to really listen to each other and understand that none of us are going anywhere, that all of us do not go as full, equal, and participating partners.
Dr. Ed, I would not be looking if I were you for that invitation from the White House anytime soon.
I really don't. Somebody called me and asked me if they should go to the White House. They have a great chance of winning a championship, and I told them I couldn't speak for them, but if it were me, there would be no way I'd be going in for a photo op with this guy. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, and sometimes you simply have to make a statement about where you stand. So, no, I don't look for an invitation to the White House, and I most certainly have no interest in sitting down across the table for him, although I understand people like my good friend Jim Brown, who I have been talking with for the last 50 years. Jim goes in, and Jim's position is clear. He said, hey, he's the president of the United States, and he comes out and says he's interested in helping to stop the killing in the black community that I've been concerned about and working on for the last 30 years. I don't care if it's a Martian in the White House. If he comes out with that statement, I'm going in, and I don't care what anybody thinks about it. And the other thing that Jim said, which I agree with, is have we become so alienated that literally from each other that literally no one can go into the White House and sit down with the man who was elected there by hook or crook? It doesn't matter. He's the president. If that's where we are, then it doesn't make any difference what his stand is on anything. We're already finished. So I can understand people who would go into the White House, and I also empathize and sympathize and identify really with those who would not.
I'm going to have to leave it there, Dr. Edwards. It's been fascinating talking to you. Wish we had more time, but thank you so much for being with us.
Anytime. Thank you. It's been a privilege.
Dr. Harry Edwards, author of The Revolt of the Black Athlete. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Doerr, Colin Muir, Monica Ramirez, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air, funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.